This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many people are fed up with panhandling. That mood is reflected in recent legislation outlawing so-called aggressive panhandling. Washington, D.C., Chicago, Phoenix, San Francisco, Seattle, and Las Vegas are among the cities that have passed such laws. Supporters of these laws say it's time to take back the streets from persistent, hostile beggars who scare away shoppers, workers, and residents. Opponents say that cities are persecuting the destitute instead of trying to solve the problems that are causing poverty, homelessness, and substance abuse. In the second half of our series on panhandling, we'll hear from representatives from both sides of the issue. My guest, Roger Connor, is executive director of the American Alliance for Rights and Responsibilities. His group assists neighborhoods and communities trying to reclaim the streets from crime and disorder. The Alliance drafted a model anti-panhandling bill and worked with the aforementioned cities. Connor described their model law against aggressive panhandling.
What it does is makes it illegal to step into someone's path and ask for money, to follow them down the street and yell curses at them if they decline to give you money. Makes it illegal to panhandle inside of a bus, a subway car, or at a bus stop where people have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And it also says that you can't panhandle in certain places like automatic teller machines, where it seems to us inherently coercive and threatening for panhandling to be going on. What's interesting is that the communities that are passing this kind of new ordinance are some of the most progressive communities in America: Atlanta, Seattle, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland. We have people in these cities are committed to making American cities work. They're committed to the American city still being here in 20 or 25 years as a place where people of many different races, ethnic groups, and social classes live together, work together, play together, use the park together. And what they realize is that that dream, the dream of American cities where different kinds of people live and work together, is really threatened today. People are abandoning our cities in droves because the old problems of crime and disorder and public schools that don't work and big bureaucracies are now compounded by the fact that your everyday trip from your home to your work requires you to run a gauntlet of unpleasant encounters with aggressive panhandlers and other sources of disorder. People leading these cities realize this, for many urban residents, is a straw that's breaking the camel's back.
What is covered by the aggressive panhandling laws that isn't already covered by assault and battery laws and other laws that are on the books protecting people on city streets?
There's no law on the books in most cities that would protect you if you're on a bus and you've got a long ride home from someone who's going to work that aisle up and down and make you feel very uncomfortable or even threatened. As long as they don't touch you, as long as they don't hit you, but they can get right up to the edge and make you feel very much like you better give money or you're threatened without violating current laws. That's why it's essential to make it clear that behavior which puts a reasonable person at risk, that they've got to give money a violation of the law might happen, that kind of behavior needs to be specifically prohibited, and that's what the statutes are doing.
Why is it that cities have, in the past few years, started passing these anti-aggressive panhandling laws? What's changed?
Panhandling has increased in numbers, and the behavior of the panhandlers has changed. There's much more panhandling behavior that's intimidating and threatening going on. If you are a woman, if you are a older person, or if you are a man who's slight of build, many of these encounters are very intimidating and frightening, and it seems like they happen every day. You can't escape it. So what happens is the employees complain to the employers. The employers move their businesses out of town if they can. The tax base shrinks, and the feedback loops are starting to work because elected politicians are listening to their constituents who say, we got to do something about this problem. It isn't fair that what the citizens are saying to their elected officials is, we have rights too. We've got the right to use our park and have a sandwich at lunch without 15 people coming up and interrupting our lunch. We've got the right to walk down the street without somebody blocking our path until we give money. And we've got a right to ride home on the subway in peace at the end of a busy day and not have 10 people shoving cups into our face. And the politicians are responding to that.
Well, speaking of rights, how do you see the balance of rights between a panhandler's freedom of speech to ask for money and the right of pedestrians and business owners and employees to not be bothered by people who are asking them for money?
I think that the panhandler's rights end at the end of an outstretched hand, that there is no right to hassle your fellow citizens for money. You have no right to follow someone down the street who turns you down. You have no right to step in and obstruct their path as they're walking down the street in order to distract them. You have no right to go into places which are inherently confining, like automatic teller machine lobbies or buses or subways. The courts that have looked at this so far have all agreed there is not some absolute constitutional right to panhandle. Some of the courts who've looked at it have said that panhandling is not speech, that panhandling is not like giving a political speech or trying to convince someone that they should join your religion, that it's more like selling hot dogs from a stand. And the courts have always agreed that cities can regulate people who want to sell stuff from the street, even though they're talking when they're selling. Just because there's conversation doesn't make something protected speech. The courts draw distinctions. And so the court in New York, the Court of Appeals, that upheld the subway ban on panhandling, said that begging is not speech within the meaning of the Constitution. It's not the same as a political speech. It's a quasi-commercial transaction in which the person is saying, give me money. And if you can regulate the behavior of those who say, give me money for products, surely you can regulate the behavior of those who say, give me money for nothing.
You have a model anti-panhandling law. Following that law, when it's enforced, where should a police officer take somebody who's panhandling? What should happen to them next?
I think we have some models here. If we need to view law enforcement as one more tool for intervention with people who are either misbehaving or who are in trouble. Now, oftentimes, all you need is for the police officer to essentially warn somebody, to tell them these are the rules. You can't engage in that behavior. You can't follow someone. You can't step into your path. I saw you do it. Don't do it again. And here in Washington, D.C., where an ordinance was passed, which we drafted, they haven't had to have a lot of arrests. In fact, you now have panhandlers at DuPont Circle here in Washington, D.C., that have signs on their chest saying, non-aggressive panhandler. You have stores with signs in the window saying, if someone panhandles in an aggressive fashion, here's the number to call. And they haven't had to have very many arrests because the word has gotten around. The behavior of those who engage in panhandling is something that can be changed, usually with very low levels of intervention. Now, where the person has a serious problem, for example, that they engage in this behavior because they've stopped taking antipsychotic medication or because they're high on crack or PCP, the police officers who are trained to recognize these conditions recognize that they're dealing with a medical problem, not with a legal problem, and should be intervening to refer these people to the appropriate social services.
In looking at the history of begging laws over the years, have you found any that you thought were particularly revealing of their times and of their time's attitude toward panhandling?
You know, in Elizabethan England, there was a panhandling ban in communities, and it was illegal for anyone from outside the community to panhandle within the community. Only those who lived there could panhandle there. And it seemed to suggest a view that people knew who their own destitute were and what their circumstances and whether they were truthful and there through no fault of their own. Whereas the outsider was presumed to be someone who would be told by the local gendarme to move on.
The problem with that is in most downtowns, I mean, you don't even know who lives in your own apartment building half the time, so I don't see how
it speaks
how
legions
a community could recognize its
no,
own that.
That's
that,
right. It speaks well. Legions, doesn't it, about the collapse in connectedness. Because, you see, most of us are connected, especially throughout our lives. We're connected with each other by trust. And The panhandlers who are either aggressive or abusive or playing con games, they're chipping away at that trust. Because at the point at which the American people or any individual feels that this group of homeless advocates and homeless people are basically a great big con designed to get our money and support people who are unwilling to take care of themselves, we've lost any chance for public support for the sober housing, transitional housing, drug and alcohol treatment, and support for children and the mentally ill persons who are homeless through absolutely no fault of their own. And so we should all be very alert not to not support behaviors or policies which chip away at this public trust.
My guest is Roger Connor, Executive Director of the American Alliance for Rights and Responsibilities. The Alliance drafted a model anti-panhandling bill. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Roger Connor. You wrote a book called The Winnable, you co-wrote it actually, I believe, called The Winnable War, A Community Guide to Eradicating Street Drug Markets. I'm wondering if your research into street drugs has affected your views on panhandling. And I ask that knowing that there is a percentage of panhandlers who are also substance abusers.
Yeah. It really colored my thinking on this to work with community groups across the country who are trying to get drug dealing out of their neighborhoods. Because what I learned from them is that points of disorder in a community are the first step down the slippery slope. Because the drug dealers look for points of disorder to set up shop, because they can insinuate themselves into groups of people who are doing other things. And we've got to solve the problems like the open-air drug markets and the other forms of disorder that are growing in big cities, or people are just going to abandon them and leave. And we'll end up with our major cities being enclaves of the very rich who live in armed camps, and the destitute and the forgotten people in our society. And if you think we have compassion fatigue today, what we will have is human abandonment tomorrow. That's where we're headed. And that's why I think it's so so frustrated and so wrong-headed that people who say they're defending homeless people defend panhandling and aggressive panhandling. Because what they are doing, they're throwing a dead cat into the well of public support for the programs we need for the homeless.
Did you ever go through a period where you gave to panhandlers?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. My family became homeless at one time when I was a child. My father left. The family was destitute. Sold the furniture. That wasn't enough to get money for a bus trip to Dallas. And the family was broken up. I lived in an orphanage for a period of time. And I'll tell you, I can't walk past a panhandler without flashing on the feeling of being left at the orphanage, which is a very intense feeling for a 6 or 7 year old, which I was. And I think that anyone who's ever in their own life or in the life of someone they know been on the edge of being out of a home can't walk past a person asking for money without a moment of feeling for that person. But you know what I do now is I take that coin and I move it to the other pocket and add it to what I want to give to organizations who are really addressing the needs of homeless people. Because I know the facts are clear. The majority of the people that I might give to, that money is going to go to support alcoholism, drug addiction, and I'm not helping them. I'm only helping myself. And I choose to try to go beyond that and say, how could I help this person or people like them?
Some people say they prefer to give money to somebody on the street who's asking for it because they know that the money is going directly to that person. Or is they're afraid if they gave money to an organization that works on behalf of the homeless, the money would go for overhead or for administration, or some of it might not go directly to those homeless people.
Someone who has those concerns, buy one extra can of food a week and put it into a sack on your back porch. And then every 3 months, the sack will be full. Take it down to your local food bank, and then you'll know exactly where your money's going.
Did you beg when you were abandoned by your parents?
No. What happened was a Baptist orphanage took the children in, and friends drove, there wasn't enough money for bus tickets, and so the older children came down on the bus, and a friend drove my mother and the children to the orphanage where we lived for a year. And then after the family was reorganized and got back together, thank God, there was public housing, which at that time was functional and provided what we would today call transitional housing, so that when the family moved out of the orphanage, which was sort of the equivalent in modern times of a shelter, there was transitional housing, and we lived in that transitional housing for a period of time, and ultimately the family got back on its feet, and I was able to resume for the rest of my childhood living with my family. And, you know, that's the model I have in my mind, that is the community delivering on its responsibility to especially the children who are homeless through no fault of their own. And I believe that we have responsibilities as human beings to those who are destitute, those who have fallen into addiction to drugs and alcohol, those who are mentally ill, and children whose parents, for one reason or another, have abandoned them. I believe we have responsibilities we're not delivering on. But I also believe that the group of people I've just described have responsibilities to the community, because you can't have a society with all rights and no responsibilities. It doesn't work. And what's making people angry and resentful toward the homeless right now is the feeling that the homeless advocates assert that the people have the right to a panhandle, even to panhandle aggressively. They have the right to housing at taxpayer expense, medical care at taxpayer expense, food, clothing, shelter, but that they have no responsibility to respect the civility of the community in return. That attitude is making people angry.
A report issued by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty in Washington, D.C., found that just as the number of ordinances against panhandling and against sleeping on the streets is growing, there's also a growing number of ordinances limiting the neighborhoods where you can have shelters for the homeless or social service programs for the homeless, so that, you know, at the same time it's harder to be homeless or begging on the streets, it's also harder to find a place where you can build a shelter, an SRO. Does that jive with your information?
I think it's a very important problem that there is growing resistance in neighborhoods to the placement of neighborhood-based facilities of all kinds, whether it's drug and alcohol treatment or retarded children, mentally ill persons, you name it. Community-based facilities are drawing tremendous resistance from neighborhoods all over the country. And this is a tremendous problem, because if we're going to have the facilities that a lot of people talk about as needed, you're not going to be able to put them all in warehouse districts. So it's a very important problem to get communities to recognize that there is a social contract here and that these are fellow human beings. That being said, part of the resistance of neighborhoods, however, is legitimate, because some of the shelter operators, some of the, let's say, facility operators, have not recognized that they have a responsibility to the surrounding neighborhood, and become magnets for disreputable and threatening behavior to their neighbors, and don't do anything about it. Let me be concrete and specific here. In San Francisco, you have an area called the North of Bay Problem Solving Council. So it's in the inner city of San Francisco. And what the shelter providers agreed to do, this was a multi-service facility where homeless people came to be then referred to other facilities. And the neighbors were all afraid that they would have basically an encampment of homeless people all around this facility, which would make the neighborhood very unpleasant. The shelter providers agreed that they would work with the police who patrolled in the area. And if one of their clients was seen urinating in the street, sleeping in a public place overnight, such as on people's steps, defecating in the street, or panhandling in an aggressive fashion, the policeman would tell the shelter operator or the facility operator, and they would counsel that person that this is not behavior that is appropriate. And in fact, this sort of behavior is part of your problem, so let's deal with the problems. So they entered into, in essence, a contract with the neighborhood that they would work with their clients not to create problems in the neighborhood. But you know what happened? The ACLU of Northern California threatened to sue the multi-service provider because, and the police, because for the police to inform them of the fact that these people were doing things that were violating the law was violating the right of privacy of the people who were urinating in public or whatever. And as a result, that effort was destroyed.
In the years that you've been involved with issues pertaining to panhandling and to homelessness, has your thinking undergone any fundamental change?
The big change in my own thinking has been the dawning awareness of the powerful role played by alcohol addiction, and alcohol addiction in particular, in the presence of large numbers of dysfunctional people in our urban communities. Because of the media, I sort of knew about drug addiction and knew that drug addiction could pull somebody down. But alcoholism had not been present in my own family. So it was a real eye-opener for me to see what a huge percentage of the dysfunctional people living in our urban, living on the streets, are there because they've been dragged down by alcohol addiction. And so it was the recognition of the powerful role of addiction. That was the first thing that changed for me. The second thing that changed for me was realizing that the people who are trying to do something about the panhandling and other related problems are not reactionary property owners. Instead, they are the progressive urban reformers, the people who are trying to save our cities and make them better. So where I expected to find Bull Connor, I found Maynard Jackson. Where I expected to find some extreme uncaring person, I found Norman Rice, the mayor of Seattle. Heroes for anybody who has watched what's happening in urban America. And so it was the discovery that it was the people who are trying to make life better in troubled communities who want something done about aggressive panhandling and drug dealing and similar kinds of behavior that made me really go back and rethink and realize that this is not a liberal versus conservative battle. This is really a battle between people who, on the one hand, think that individual autonomy is the supreme value, and against them are people who argue that community and the bonds between us are just as important as individual autonomy, and that protecting the institutions of community, which include the sidewalks and parks, is extremely important to having a place where we all want to live.
Roger Connor, thank you very much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed it.
Roger Connor is Executive Director of the American Alliance for Rights and Responsibilities. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.